Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, there are some 36 situations that could be considered pre-genocidal, according to scholars of genocide. We'll explore the lessons we've learned from past genocides. Then, cancer in the environment, increasing evidence that the cancer epidemic is linked to chemicals in the environment. Scholars of genocide have identified nearly 36 situations around the world that could be considered pre-genocidal. These are states that could attempt to annihilate their ethnic and religious minorities. What have we learned from past genocides, such as the one that occurred in Rwanda in April of 1994? We're joined by General Romeo Dallaire. He was commander of the peacekeeping forces in Rwanda and had tried to stop the mass killing of the Tutsi people there. He is also the co-director of the Will to Intervene Project and the author of two books, Shake Hands with the Devil and They Fight Like Soldiers, They Die Like Children. General Dallaire, I wonder if we could start with your return to Rwanda. I recently revisited a talk you gave on the internet where you addressed the Rwandan people and where you apologized for your failures.
In my tour, the 10th anniversary, I said that I would like to stop and speak at a class at University of Butare, the National University. We're doing the trip around the country. When we arrived there, they had to move it to the outside stadium, football stadium. And there was about 7,000 people there. And so I spoke. And one of the things I emphasized, not only the fact that I, as the commander of the mission, failed and my mission failed to protect them and to establish an atmosphere of security, I said the era of the white man coming back to Africa to reestablish security and so on is over. I said the sub-Saharan black African is simply not going to attract the engagement of the developed world, the North, unless there is a self-interest in there, and a country like Rwanda doesn't have that. And I said, you will have to take on, through your organizations like the African Union, the ability to self-protect. As I was saying, the white man is not coming back. The clouds had started to form because it was a rainy season. So in the rainy season, it's lovely sunny, and all of a sudden, boom, clouds appear. And then the next thing you know, downpour. And as I'm saying this, the sky got black. And I had just finished saying it. And this incredible thunder clap just happened. And it reverberated over the corrugated scale roofs of the stadium. And it was an incredible reaction. And it just made such an impact that afterwards so many of them came back and said, even the skies recognized that we were into a new era.
One of the things you said on the video that I did see was you were talking about how the Western world and the United Nations responded to Yugoslavia. Mm-hmm. But not to Rwanda.
Yeah. The video you mentioned, which is also called Shake Hands with the Devil, of my trip back at the 10th anniversary with my wife and rewalking the terrain of the genocide. One of the horrific quandaries in which you find yourself in the field is that you have to operate with what you're given, but you're also conscious of what's going on elsewhere. And as I was fighting to get even a budget, let alone the troops I needed, even getting them food, and then the genocide explodes, and the next thing I know, countries are pulling their troops out, and I'm getting the orders, in fact, to withdraw, which I'm refusing. At the same time, Dayton had happened, and we deployed 67,000 troops in ex-Yugoslavia. And the question is how come I couldn't keep 450 soldiers to provide protection to a small portion of that population, and there were more people killed, injured, internally displaced, refugeed, and raped in 100 days in Rwanda than there was in the 6 years of the Yugoslavian campaign? And so what are the criteria that our political elites use? I think the most pejorative side of that is our populations and citizens let them get away with to decide that they're going to invest massively in a European country that's internally hemorrhaging, but that sub-Saharan black Africans simply don't count. Not only that, but Yugoslavia has no real significant natural resource. It's just situated in Europe. You sort of say, well, you know, it's there as part of maybe the European security context. In Rwanda, there was nothing there either. But the people didn't at all feel ashamed of saying that, you know, there's nothing in Rwanda. There's no oil, no strategic resource. There's nothing of any value. Anything that's there are human beings, and there's too many of them anyway. And so they used that argument.
Did you actually hear that argument?
No. I was briefed. Nations and powerful nations came in within the first week to do assessments. They sent in a small reconnaissance team to look at the situation and then to be able to go back to their national capitals and then decide whether or not they're going to give the UN any resources. That's where the exercise changed in regards to who really is ultimately responsible. Up until the time that these nation states actually came on the ground and looked at the situation, the UN was running the show, and the UN was providing the information to the Security Council, and they were feeding all the nations and all the national capitals and so on. But when these countries came to Rwanda, looked at it and decided they weren't not going to come in, then that meant that they had decided that they would not provide the UN with the resources it needed to stop the genocide. Then that responsibility of the genocide fell on those nation states. And so ultimately, the culprit, or the ones that are really have blood on their hands, are not necessarily the Secretariat of the UN, nor in the field, although we made mistakes, and of course we have a sense of responsibility, as I do as the mission force commander. But those who deliberately took decisions not to provide the UN with any assets to influence the situation, they're the ones that are to be held accountable for the continuum of the slaughter and ultimately the genocide. And that's every nation state in the world. That's why the subtitle of my book, Shake Hands with the Devil, is The Failure of Humanity in Rwanda. They completely lost their sense of humanity amongst themselves with the slaughter. But the rest of humanity abandoned the Rwandans.
So you named several failures that we have to learn from. The failure in humanity in Rwanda, the failure of humanity in the international community, perhaps it's even a bigger failure in that it's what shapes our considerations. And then it sounds like the institutional failures as well.
It would be just too easy to use the only international body that exists that has the ability to bring nations together and regions of the world together on a variety of subjects. I mean, the UN was founded by those five permanent members essentially to prevent them from going to war with each other. And all the rest of the stuff that's come on since, you know, UNESCO and everything else, UNICEF, have been additions in the maturing of that ability. And peacekeeping only started in 1956 with the concept where belligerents decide that they don't want to fight anymore, and they need a sort of a referee to make sure that people play by the rules as they reestablish them. The concept was based on the fact that nation states would be going after other nation states. And then when the Cold War ended, it found itself all of a sudden facing a whole series of imploding nations and failing states that previously had been held under wraps by the big powers, in fact, mostly the permanent five, who had put a lot of dictators in power and, you know, kept control on these artificial countries that came out of the colonial era. So bingo, they find themselves all of a sudden having to face these catastrophic failures with very, very demanding timelines. There's revolutions, there's assassinations, there's breakdown in social structures, and worse than that, there's massive abuse of human rights. There's a fundamental sort of visceral desire to sort these problems out by actually going at the other ethnicities, tribalism, and religious reasons. So much of that explodes. It didn't come on slowly. It exploded. And it was the Cambodia, it was Somalia due to famine. You had the Congo that was starting up. And in Central Africa, you had also Burundi that had a coup d'etat, and then Rwanda, which was in a civil war. And on the West Africa, well, you had Sierra Leone that was teetering on war. You had Liberia. I mean, this place was just festering of peoples wanting to sort out what their nation state should be, because they were created in artificial boundaries with no logic at all in their sort of ethnic groups or whatever. The UN all of a sudden faces this, and the international community says, oh, by the by, Cold War is over, peace dividend, we don't need big militaries anymore. We don't have to spend on expensive security systems. Life is going to be in a new world order. George Bush Sr. Yeah. said that. And on the contrary, it may have sounded secure up in the northern part in the Europe sort of developed world, at least for a while, until Yugoslavia exploded. The rest of the world was going to hell in a handbasket. And the UN was the only body left to pick up the pieces, didn't have the tools, didn't have the people, didn't have the structure. Peacekeeping was a very small little select group of about 13 developed countries that would go in, you know, when nation states were at each other. All of a sudden, what you needed was fighting troops. You needed people who could defend others. And it exploded into something of an order by the time I got there in 93 of about 50,000 troops around the world with no equipment, no logistics, and mandates that people were pulling out of the air to try to figure out. I mean, my mandate was establish an atmosphere of security. So you sort of say, okay, I've been 30 years in NATO, and my mandates have been to attack, defend, withdraw, bypass. You know, I've even handled nuclear weapons. All of a sudden, I'm in a developing country in the middle of nowhere, and I'm told to establish an atmosphere of security. And the question is, what does establish mean? Do I defend the country when I'm demobilizing both armies against a third party? How far do I use my troops in using force to establish? And what is an atmosphere of security? Right. A police state? No weapons? And so mandates started to come out. No resources came to the UN because at that time, the big powers, in particular the United States, had said, that's it. We're not paying anymore because a lot of this money is wasted. So massive deficits were there. We couldn't get budgets to deploy troops. And the real kicker in this comes from the fact that the developed countries start to do a Pontius Pilate trick on the UN. And what they do is they say, okay, these are all brush wars and these are problems there and so on. There's really nothing in it for us that much. And on top of that, you got Somalia and you got Black Hawk Down, and Bill Clinton gets cold feet and pulls out, or accelerates anyways the pull out. So the world power is not keen on playing in this. And so the UN has to go to developing countries to pick up the slack. And they've got no skills, they've got no equipment, they've got no logistics. And yet the same permanent five are still creating mandates to go into Cambodia and go into Mozambique and in Rwanda. But we don't want you to spend money. We want you to minimum force, minimum capabilities, and get out of there as fast as you can. Well, that abdication by the developed world, the white world in particular, to letting the UN carry the can, established the whole strategic scenario in which ultimately, extremists could thrive because they argued that nobody's really going to come. And that's what these guys did in Rwanda. They developed a genocide plan. I mean, they sat around, they developed a plan right down to every 10 huts in the country. They had lists of every Tutsi, where they were. They had lists of every intermarried couple that existed. And the militia was created out of their youth movement that they trained and armed and equipped, and it was all evolving. We were passing all that information up, and there was nothing coming back because nobody wanted to play in it. Why? Because they were all busy with sort of Cambodia, maybe closing down a bit. We were busy with Haiti that was cranking up, that's close to home, and Yugoslavia was building up. So, hey, Rwanda, who's interested? So from a situation during the Cold War of maybe three or four missions going on at any time, and all of them Chapter 6, non-threatening, we end up by 1993 with 15 UN missions, and all of them are Chapter 7, which means the use of force. The last time they had used a Chapter 7 in the Cold War was Korea. So you can imagine the learning curve, particularly within the UN structure, but also the nations that are trying to fill the void abandoned by developed countries. And abandoned is not a facile statement because when in Rwanda during the genocide, I was able to convince a number of Franco and Anglo-African nations to provide me with the battalions I needed, I couldn't get them there because the developed countries didn't want to give me the strategic lift to move them. And then when we worked out a deal that the developed countries would sort of sponsor a battalion. As an example, the Americans were going to sponsor the Ghanaian battalion. So they needed armored personnel vehicles. They needed radios and machine guns. Out of the thousands of armored vehicles sitting in Germany, doing nothing but rusting, they went into a lengthy negotiation of rental. So the United States rented 50 armored personnel vehicles for $14 million. And it took over a month to negotiate it, let alone get the stuff there, get it painted white, put the radios in it that we were scrounging from somewhere else. It was perverse, absolutely perverse. Meanwhile, behind the scenes, the French are fiddling with the extremists because the French believe that Rwanda is going to turn into an Anglo country because the rebels were Anglophiles. And they thought that the Americans were really trying to muscle into their realm of the Franco Africa. And so they were supporting
the
one side.
Government.
Yeah. And so you get also a nation, a world power, supporting the extremists to the extent of supporting them that they then convinced the UN, which has nothing left. I mean, it's got nothing in the bins. It's got no money.
And what month is this roughly now?
We're now in about the end of May, June. So we're 2 months into the genocide. We've got about 500,000 bodies floating all over the place. And we're close to about 3 million people.
And the French are still supporting the Hutu, knowing that there are 500,000 bodies.
To the extent that they convinced the Security Council that it's unacceptable to continue to see this slaughter going on. Because they all hoped that the thing would end in a couple of weeks, but it didn't. It kept on going because there was nothing to stop them. The French said, we got to stop this. They said, we want a Chapter 7 mission, and we're going to go in with a combined force of Franco-African countries, and we will establish a humanitarian protection zone. So what they do is they bring in about 2,000 French soldiers. Most of them were already in Africa and other areas. And they bring in a platoon from Senegal and a platoon from Mali and a couple others to just sort of give them a color of being a multilateral force. And they come in with Jaguar jets, armored vehicles, heavy guns and so on. And they're not coming in there to establish a humanitarian protection zone. They're coming in for a big fight. And so I end up as a Chapter 6 mission that was a peacekeeping mission, establishing the demilitarized zone between the rebel forces that are advancing and winning and the French forces that are trying to establish a humanitarian protection zone, which really is a zone where the extremists were hiding and rearming. So I'm a UN mission being the patroller and the negotiator between the other UN mission and the rebel force.
You just made me think when you're talking about the rebel forces and Paul Kagame, who I think is still president, He's kind of become a Western media darling in a way. Mm. But there's been some talk in certain academic circles that he was leading an equally brutal force and then also shot down the plane of the president, allegedly. Do you think that Paul Kagame is as culpable as, say, the other side?
No, and no, in all the questions. There is no doubt that Paul Kagame is ruthless. He grew up in a refugee camp. Their family was thrown out of Rwanda by the Hutu extremists, fought with Museveni to get rid of Idi Amin and Obote, studied here in the United States at Leavenworth, a very effective commander. His officers and NCOs were very effective in the Ugandan army. So they were then under pressure from the Ugandans to get out of Uganda. These refugee camps were creating problems for them. And so they wanted to go back to Rwanda or at least get a Rwandan passport so they can go somewhere else. Rwandans refused and that took off the war. So he's got a big chip on his shoulder on how his family and him, they have been treated and how they find themselves after fighting for the Ugandans being thrown out but not having a place to go. So they take matters in their own hands. So you do have a rebel force, however, that is incredibly disciplined and well-trained and well-motivated and focused and well-led with a political structure that has a very high educated strata to it that has looked at what they want to do should they win the war. On the other side, you've got a government force and a government structure that is torn between extremists and moderates, that is a force that is not well-trained, not well-motivated, that is really nearly decrepit, except for some elite units, and has within it a visceral hatred for the Tutsis that is nurtured by the political elite wing, which is extremist, that is influencing the whole of the structure of not only military, but the gendarmerie and also the public service. So you've got this gang that essentially has said that the only way we're going to be able to keep power, because we've got a dictator here, is by eliminating the opposition. And the peace agreement that was signed in 93 essentially eroded so much of the power of the dictator that they felt that they were in fact vulnerable to being thrown in jail, these extremists. The power struggle was, how do we get rid of the Tutsis in order to sustain power, and can we do it? And their assessment of what the reaction of the international community was is, we probably would be able to pull it off. They had seen what had happened in coup d'etat in Burundi in October, and there had been next to no response. And I ended up with 300,000 Burundi refugees and over 40,000 bodies floating in the river. So there was next to no reaction in the international community. They thought that they would be able to pull it off, and so they did it. So there was, on one side, a very structured force with a deliberate aim that they were coming back home and they wanted their share of power. On the other side, you had a gang that had taken power but had sort of languished in ineptitude under a dictator, and their structures were riddled by extremist thinking, but also caught up in a quandary because there were moderates also there, particularly in the south, that didn't necessarily agree with what was going on. So the extremists take control and they create a scenario in which they can launch their genocide, and they actually implement it. So a genocide happened. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. No revisionism by academics and all kinds of NGOs that have looked at it. Alison DeForge, even in her work previous to that, recognized that there was a genocide that happened. No problem there. Question is, with that genocide, there was a civil war. So the rebel forces are attacking the government forces. In the nature of civil wars, the general population is not on the sides and watch these soldiers fight. The general population is an instrument of war. And what you do is you create a mass of population in order to be your negotiating base when peace comes, or peace agreements, or when you have to negotiate. So the extremists decide to move the general population and exterminate the Tutsis as they're doing it. So they move millions of people. And they create fear that permits that movement by the extremist radio station that describes the rebels as demons, that they have long teeth, they even have a tail, they have horns, they eat Hutu babies, and on and on and on and on. And this is a highly illiterate population, and so whatever comes off the radio is nearly the voice of God. Add rape to that, and you have then a nation that is now mobile. With that scenario going on, they are moving massive numbers of people and they're slaughtering. The rebel forces are coming down, and what do they find? Slaughtered family. A lot of these people still had family in Rwanda. Although close to a million Tutsis escaped in 1959-60, close to a million still stayed in Rwanda. So you had at the time about 1.2 million Tutsis in the country, plus those who were mixed marriages. The bulk of them were slaughtered, and they had family in the peripheral areas, and these forces were the sons and daughters of the people who had been thrown out. And so when they're coming down through the villages and they're finding their family slaughtered, what do you think happens? So exactions go on, and they are interestingly structured in as much as Kagame court-martialed and shot soldiers who raped. He also prevented looting from happening, but he also had a strong paranoia on security. And because his force was smaller, much smaller than the other side, and of large territory with vast populations, he wanted to ensure that he had security behind him. And so he conducted a sort of a follow-on in regards to ensuring that there were no extremists left behind as they continued to advance to the country. And so there were exactions done. The scale of that is still up for grabs. How much of that was done? How many of the Hutu officers and families that were slaughtered? How many of the refugees who were Hutu came back and were culled for those who had committed slaughter? And remember, here we have no more government, we've got no more structure, and essentially to blame a person for having conducted a rape or killing of a neighbor, all you needed was 5 witnesses. And so there were, exactions. And the scale is to be questioned. But there's nowhere near the similitude or the link between an actual genocide that would have wiped out the 1.2 million Tutsis.
And almost did.
Yeah, would have done that and as its aim and then keep control of the country. And the other guy who's coming in and trying to keep control, both of his own troops, but also of establishing a secure environment, which in the scenarios of civil wars can be horrifically ruthless.
When we look at what you witnessed and what you've been thinking about, because it's clear you've been really thinking this through for some time now, and it's been, 16 years?
17 years.
17 years. Is this a situation that is unique, or is this something that we have a lot of lessons for the rest of the world that we can draw from?
It was deemed to be a vulnerability that exists in the international community in a time frame in a new era, the sort of postmodern era after the Cold War, where we have nations that were created artificially with absolutely no logic whatsoever. It was based purely on land grabs by the colonial powers and split communities, split ethnicities, tribals, and so on. People don't want to fiddle with the borders, and so they want sovereign states. But in so doing, they're also keeping a whole whack of problems in there. So we end up in a completely new era where it's not nation state going after nation state, but it is imploding nation, failing states, where we have civil wars. And there is nothing more ruthless than a civil war.
And because of the colonial powers that had gone in there, these ethnic groups really were demarcated by the colonial powers and divided. You saw this in so many countries. It wasn't just Rwanda. We saw this in Sri Lanka, for example, and we saw this in Burundi.
It was not done by all. Not all the colonial powers acted the same way, nor did they leave the same legacy. The British colonies essentially had a pretty stable bureaucracy established and system of governance there that could function without the sort of the governor general and the heavy hand. And so there was a methodology and an educated sort of elite that could handle it. Other countries, I mean, you take Portugal, you take Italy, they left nothing and ripped everything out of it and ensured that they killed as much as they could before they left. So you've got a scale of state of nations, brand new nations, and what they've got to work with. And in the context that we find ourselves is many of these nation states that had been sort of held under authoritarian regimes from the early 60s right through to the end of the Cold War, all this sort of frustration simply stayed there and festered until we said we didn't need them anymore. And so we also said, we want you to democratize and we want elections and so on. Well, how do you take a country that's been 150 years under colonial rule, then is under 25 years of a dictator, and then all of a sudden you're going to turn it in a couple of years into a democracy with a multi-party system, and its makeup has absolutely no logic because you've got one ethnicity that's 85% of the population, the other one is 14, and then there's another minority, so the 12. But so how do you create democracy and within the incredible milestones that we impose? I mean, I was given 2 years to move them to a democratic election. That was the last thing they needed. They needed to build up the institutions. They needed to have an interim government and then build slowly up the institutions of governance and the media, the whole process of bringing about a judicial system and integrating the forces and all that and have that stabilized. And then, as they're doing that, let the parties sort of present themselves, let the parties get elected with their own people, and then have an election.
If we were going to now fast forward to today and we see the uprisings going on in the Middle East, for example, are there lessons we can draw from there to then look at another set of arbitrarily created states? Mm-hmm. What do you think we can draw from your experience?
One of the fundamental changes is the fact that we're living a revolutionary era in technology. That is to say, the availability of communications down to the individual and the ability of an individual to be able to muster and sort of coalesce a lot of other individuals and sustain it through continuous communications and so build forces, build movements, build activists and so on. That did not exist then. It exists now. And it's not done in isolation because these systems are now possible to monitor from outside. And so you're getting direct inputs on a daily basis of what's happening. So nothing is done in delayed motion. Things are done in your face now all the time. That is a major factor that's different from the past. So people cannot build up things in isolation. If there's going to be a revolution, if it's going to be an uprising, so on, you can see it moving, you can inject into it right away, and you can respond to it right away because you've got it right away. Now, what did happen, however, is in the interim period, a lot of people wrote a lot of stuff. A lot of people talked a lot, and a lot of people sort of negotiated and looked at the problem of what had happened in Rwanda. We had had Cambodia before that, and we had Srebrenica going on also, and sort of saying, there's got to be a way around this. So by 1999, the UN realizes that it needed some significant reforms, and it brought in the Brahimi Report that was major reforms in how to do peace. It was a lot of tactical stuff, but very useful stuff. But the fundamental reforms were in the hand of Kofi Annan as Secretary General and was mandated by the United States, who backed him up, to bring in these reforms because the UN is ineffective. He then introduced in 2003 a significant report that had about 101 recommendations of enormous ramifications, including the makeup of the permanent members of the Security Council. And they discussed it, negotiated. And 3 months before the 2005 General Assembly, where they were going to approve these reforms to start implementing them, your ambassador, Bolton, essentially scrapped the whole damn thing. So the reforms are there to be picked up and to be applied. Nobody has really picked them up, except for one. And that was the one called Responsibility to Protect. And what that did is by 2001, a group of middle powers and so on got together and produced a doctrine that essentially...
When you say middle powers, you mean within the UN?
Well, all the countries. But middle powers, not necessarily using UN resources, but national resources and coalescing, led by Canada.
Who were the others?
Australia. Okay. There were some African countries, South Africa, Asian countries, and Germany was involved, the Dutch, the Swedes. They got together and produced a doctrine that essentially said that sovereignty is no more an absolute, because this is what these guys were hiding behind. So they said, if a leadership of a nation is massively abusing the human rights of its people or can't stop it, then the rest of the world has a responsibility through the UN to go in and protect the innocent people. And it was sold in 2005 to the world. Now, it scared a whole bunch of people. Although they agreed to it, the small countries said, hey, wait a minute, particularly those run by dictators, they said, what happens if the big boys want to use that to come in and take us on? So they started,
which is a possibility.
Yes, absolutely, and wouldn't have been the first time. So there's a concern about that. But what really caught us off guard was the big powers are saying, you know, this could drag us into stuff that we don't want to do. The United States didn't want to get into Rwanda. Nobody else was interested in Rwanda. There was nothing there. Why do we want to get in the middle of such a terrible mess? And God knows what casualties we'll have, particularly after Mogadishu. And so let's see these
and
things
play
out.
And it may also pit people within an organization like the United Nations against powers like the United States in situations like Israel-Palestine.
Well, you've got, in fact, a world body that is trying to maneuver with big powers having established their positions beforehand and not necessarily wanting to use the UN as the instrument to resolve it. They sort of wanted to do more bilateral stuff or multilateral stuff outside of the UN. So we have the proof with Libya that our responsibility to protect is there, although it's not necessarily being used as the term, but they did use it. I mean, they isolated politically Gaddafi, they isolated the country economically, and then they went in and used force to try to stop the killing. It is a first use of responsibility with the UN mandate to go into a country, a sovereign state, and try to sort the situation out. And so there's lots of learning to be done in regards of failing states and trying to reestablish nascent democracies with rule of law, good governance, human rights, gender equality, and so on. I think now the head of the iceberg of revolutions in failing states and weak nations is now obvious, and it's a matter of us trying to sort out how we want to intervene, not only militarily, but politically, economically, to hopefully one day prevent these things going catastrophic, let alone trying to stop them.
As I understood, the killing in Rwanda were mainly civilians.
It's very true and reflective of civil wars, where although you might have two warring factions, as we did in this case, we had the government forces of about 35,000. You had the rebel forces of about 12,000, 13,000. Got a not classic war, but war between fighting forces. But behind the lines is where the slaughtering and the killing went on. And it's not unlike what happened in World War II, particularly in Eastern Europe, where although the troops were fighting the Russians, behind them, the Nazis and the Gestapo were wiping out hordes and hordes of people. You had then the extremists who were not in the military as such, although there were military leaders in that, who were exacting the slaughtering behind the lines. And that's why when I presented my plan to the UN, I said, I don't care about the two warring factions. They can go and beat up on each other as much as they want. What I need is troops to stop the slaughtering behind the lines. That's where we could attenuate the need for the war. If we stopped the slaughter, then there wouldn't be a need for those two to keep fighting, because the reason of the fight was based on the fact that there was so much of the slaughtering going on. And when looking at that and assessing that, it became obvious that it wasn't all the soldiers up front that were doing the slaughtering, but the slaughtering was done by civilians. And the civilians were divided into the adults and youths. So although there was adult leadership, the bulk of the killing were done by the militia, the Interahamwe. And the Interahamwe was the youth wing of the political extreme party that had been converted into a militia. And so we're talking about 16 and 17-year-olds and 18 and 19-year-olds doing the bulk of the killing. It's these kids who had been indoctrinated and drugged up and, you know, boozed up and so on, and also fear, going around and just slaughtering left, right, and center. So many of the checkpoints were manned by kids, either armed with the machetes or armed with the AK-47s, and they were responsible for a lot of the killing under adult supervision.
One of the issues with children is that their ethical development hasn't really solidified yet.
No, and that's why Canada and the United States led the charge in the year 2000 to establish the Optional Protocol on Child Rights that essentially says that anybody under the age of 18 is not to be armed, trained, or used in conflict because they are not considered to have the mature references in order to be able to take those decisions as adults. Now, people have argued that in certain societies, at 15, they're considered adults. Because by age, they're considered adults, and because the cultural milieu has given them responsibilities much younger than in other societies, doesn't mean that psychologically they're more prepared than the others. It just means that the community, the culture, has thrust that on them at an earlier age. That optional protocol, which was established, creates the criteria by which, if under the age of 18 are used, they're not to be held criminally responsible. They are, on the contrary, to be demobilized, rehabilitated, reintegrated, and, where required, put through a judicial system that is non-punitive. That's the baseline, and that's the reference of us going after anybody who's using children and arming them as primary weapons in wars around the world to the tune of 250 to 300,000 at any one time.
There is a growth in extremism in the Western world, in Europe and the United States. And the United States has big growth in militia movements. What does it take to convince, and the word you use, indoctrinate, people to hate another group, like you saw in Rwanda? Is there something that you can draw from there to apply to the Western world, or is it not applicable?
It is the easiest route possible. It is a lot more difficult to accept the frictions of our differences and work within them than to simply use the frictions of our differences as tools of intolerance. We have in our developed world, and in Canada, the United States, very similar in our values and our sort of ethical references, our moral sort of standards, is that we have moved from, remember, in the 60s, this was massive abuses of human rights in those days in a country that is to lead the world in advancing human rights and democracy and freedom for all. We're not that far away from that experience, and we're into an era now where, because people can communicate so easily and people have more generally money and means, we tried to use that by moving a concept called tolerance. And so reconciliation and tolerance, and, you know, we tolerate each other. But that has fundamentally backfired, because when you establish an atmosphere of tolerance, it means that somebody is tolerating somebody else. That means that there's something there that's still in their gut that makes them still not comfortable. However, if we had moved to a higher plane, that is to say, if we had said, we are to respect each other because we are equal.
And embrace the differences.
You work within them. Yeah. It's not easy, but you work with it. Just look at, what if your daughter, your Caucasian family, and brings home a Black or Hispanic person. How easy is that accepted? Now, still today, in our communities.
More and more, but yes.
Still. Yeah. So that reconciliation process is ongoing and is difficult and needs all the tools that we can bring to bear, the communications tools, the instruments, social structures, and so on, to attenuate the frictions and have people respect each other. Now, because that concept is not prevalent, I mean, we're working on it, so on. And the concept of tolerance is still there. There are those who simply say, I don't tolerate this. And that is still an easy argument to use, which then permits, because of money, because of resources available, people can then coalesce in a negative sense. And so you get these militias and these extremist groups. How do you handle that? Two ways. One, you must be ruthless but fair. You weed them out. You literally take on these organizations that are fundamentally against the fundamental laws of the nation. There is no call for militia vigilante entities outside of the legal processes and institutions to defend the nation. There's no room for that. It's not acceptable. And so you take them on that way. Secondly, you work through education.
Can media be used
positively?
It's part of the education.
Well, its role is to be objective. And if it is objective, if it is transparent, it will provide you with the information you need to take objective decisions. But look at your media in this country.
Absolutely.
And tell me that all the media are working on a premise of objectivity.
Or any of them anymore in the broadcast world.
Well, I mean, you've got on one side, you've got the Lehrer Report on PBS, which has its sort of rent. And on the other side, you've got what? Fox. And I was interviewed in New York by a group. They were doing a special on Kofi Annan. And all the questions were skewed. They were not questions based on an objective point of view that you wanted to objectively present. They were skewed. They were sort of nuanced. And so your answers continuously either were defensive of whatever you were trying to defend, or you found yourself responding to absolutely fringe arguments without getting into the content. So at the end of it, and I was quite peeved, I asked this journalist, I said, what were you trying to do with this? I said, were you trying to get a story on Kofi Annan, or were you trying to crucify Kofi Annan? And blatantly, I was told, we're trying to crucify him. And she was from Fox.
Yeah.
So if the general population just takes one point of view then we are in serious problems. However, if you've got a spectrum of points of view, because objectivity is so difficult to sustain in a business world and competitive world, then what you hope is your population is going to look at the spectrum. And so they're going to read or listen to from National Public Radio on one side all the way to Fox, and they'll make up their mind from that. And hopefully they don't focus on the one that makes them feel good and feeds them their perspective versus giving them an opportunity to take objective decisions. So we may be sophisticated societies, but it doesn't necessarily mean that we're mature.
Or still, doesn't mean that we're not necessarily emotional.
Emotional can provide positive.
It can.
Yeah. But excess nationalism is a perfect source of division and can curtail good arguments coming to the fore. Excess nationalism prevented a lot of arguments on Iraq, a lot of arguments on Afghanistan, and so on. And in so doing, curtailed the objectivity that, in fact, you expect from a sophisticated society like the United States. And all the more so when the United States is the world leader. I mean, if you were the 163rd out of 193 countries, people would say, well, so what? But if you're number two or one in the world, there's a requirement that your citizenry achieve a level of sophistication and maturity to be able to master that incredible power and that innate responsibility beyond your borders.
Thank you so much, Senator Dallaire,
yeah.
General Dallaire.
Yeah.
It's great to have you with us.
Thank you.
When we come back, cancer in the environment. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar's Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. Cancer has become the second leading cause of death in the U.S. and the number one killer among Americans under the age of 85. More than 40% of Americans will contract the disease at some point in their lifetimes. That is an increase from 25% in the 1950s. So what is causing the growth in cancer rates? Increasingly, scientists are pointing to toxic chemicals in our environment. We have with us Sandra Steingraber. She's an ecologist, cancer survivor, and author of Living Downstream, an Ecologist's Personal Investigation of Cancer in the Environment. After battling bladder cancer at age 20, Steingraber has been working to expose environmental links to cancer. And in the film, she expresses urgency with which we should look at what we put in the environment and in our own bodies.
As a young biologist, when I was diagnosed with bladder cancer, I asked that question that all people who are newly diagnosed with cancer ask, which is, why me? But as a biologist, I ask it in a very biological way. I would go into the hospital to have my checkups and to sit with other cancer patients, and I would try to engage physicians or nurses about environmental causes of cancer. And that was just not part of the conversation. It was just outside the frame of the discussion. And yet, I could go back to my scientific data and go into the medical library and look up information about carcinogens and cancer, and there's quite a vast body of knowledge. So I was very puzzled. You know, why is there this breach between what scientists know and even what the medical community talks about to their patients about causes of cancer? It seemed like somebody needed to build a bridge.
That was Sandra Steingraber in her film. The book is called Living Downstream. Welcome, Sandra Steingraber. Great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
I think what I'd like to do is start with the trends that you talk about in your book with cancer. Some have increased, some have decreased. What is the trend and what's happening behind them?
Well, I guess the good news here is that overall cancer incidence is actually down. And when you take a look at what is driving that decrease, it turns out that the engine behind it is one thing, which is a decision on the part of white men to stop smoking en masse about two decades ago. So lung cancer rates among white men are down, and therefore we've dragged down the whole incidence data for cancer, which is great because what that tells us is that when you remove exposure to a carcinogen, you actually prevent cancer. And so it's a great testimony to the success of tobacco abolition efforts. But when you disaggregate the data and you look more closely at individual trends, some different patterns emerge. So, for example, you see that cancer among children and young adults has been rising, and even cancer among infants from 1975 up to the present. The kind of cancer I had, bladder cancer, is on the increase. So is multiple myeloma, a very painful cancer of the bone marrow, liver cancer, thyroid cancer, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and testicular cancer among young men, ovarian cancer among U.S. girls, and brain tumors among all age groups. And so we have unfortunate increases in those cancers, and we don't know of any particular genetic factors influencing those cancers, nor are they related to tobacco, with the possible exception of bladder cancer. Nevertheless, it wasn't a factor in my disease. And so we really need to look elsewhere for explanations for these trends.
Now, you have looked at some of these, and for example, you looked at breast cancer, and you said U.S. women have the highest rates in the world, but there's been some decline. And you looked at some possible explanations. You said there are four, such as hormones. Why don't you tell us what these four possible explanations are behind breast cancer?
I think the best explanation for the possible decline in breast cancer incidence that we've seen, which is not nearly dramatic, I should say, as the decline in lung cancer among men, but there does seem to be at least a plateauing of breast cancer incidence, nevertheless, at a very historically high level. And I think the best hypothesis is that it follows the decision on the part of women in 2003 to stop using hormone replacement therapy after menopause in great numbers. That was the year that a study was published demonstrating that, in fact, taking estrogenic pharmaceuticals after menopause to control the symptoms of menopause actually contributed to breast cancer risk, as well as to increased risk for dementing disorders and cardiovascular problems. And so when that report was released, lots of women just forswore hormone replacement drugs. And the result in California was a very rapid decline in breast cancer incidence. And the reason I'm a little bit agnostic about this is I'm really waiting to see what the data look like in the years to come, because sometimes what looks like a drop is really just caused by lack of complete data in more recent years as compared to older years where the data are more complete. And so we'll see what happens. But I think, again, the explanation for that trend is that we removed, if not a carcinogen, at least a chemical, namely estrogen, that serves as a fuel for a certain kind of cancer, namely breast cancer.
Now, I noted the American Cancer Society, you cited them in your book, having identified 216 chemicals that are known to cause cancer. And 73 are in foods or consumer products, 35 are air pollutants, 29 are produced in the U.S. in large amounts. And these are still throughout the environment.
They are, and that study was done by the scientists at the Silent Spring Institute and published in the journal Cancer, which is the American Cancer Society's flagship journal, and those results show us a couple of things. One is the fact that nobody had ever thought to look to see how many breast carcinogens are out there in use, either in consumer products or as air pollutants or as pesticides and so forth. And so the fact that it took this long to even do the count is kind of astonishing. And then the other, I think, interesting point is that, you know, the American Cancer Society funded the research, but now is been actively disparaging the President's Cancer Panel report in its conclusion, which I think is consistent with the study that you just cited. The conclusion of this report is that the burden of cancer caused by the environment has been grievously underestimated, and we really need to be looking to the environment as the driver for a lot more cancers than we thought. In other words, the report from the President's Cancer Panel shows us that we've been trivializing the role of the environment, and that it serves as an important corrective and shines a spotlight on what we do know.
Given your own experience and also the experience of Rachel Carson, you followed her footsteps quite a bit in this book, does this report that you're talking about really give you any kind of hope in terms of being able to put the chemical industries on some kind of notice and get some regulation? I mean, the report actually did blame the lax law enforcement.
That's right. Well, I think it's a very powerful report, and I mean, I've always been hopeful about this issue, and perhaps it's because I'm a cancer survivor myself, and I've learned how to have hope in times of great desperation, but it seems to me that the demonstrable evidence showing us that the environment plays a bigger role in the burden of cancer than we had previously assumed is really good and hopeful news, because we can do something about that. I mean, it's people who put chemicals into the environment. We people are in charge of the economies that we run and the kind of consumer goods that are produced, and are in charge of our chemical industry. So if we're using feedstocks that are inherently toxic and contributing to cancer, we can change that through green chemistry and green engineering. If, on the other hand, the evidence had shown us, let's say, that inherited genes were the main driver of cancer, and that happily is not our case. Inheritance is thought all by itself to account for only about 5% of all cancers. But let's say it counted for the majority. That would be terrible news, because there would be nothing we could do about that. We can't go back and change our ancestors. We would just have to sit around and wait for our genes to mutate or something, you know. But happily, that's not our case. We have a meaningful place to begin a program of cancer prevention, and that is by protecting people from the chemicals that cause cancer.
You did your own efforts to expose these connections and the interwovenness, as you call it. The chemical industries tried to essentially discredit Rachel Carson. Did you also have that experience, and do you think that that can change now?
I didn't have the same experience that Carson had, and I really attribute the difference to two things. First of all, when Carson wrote Silent Spring, she was so prescient. You know, she really went out on a limb with available evidence that she had at the time. And we didn't even have cancer registry data, so we didn't have good data on time trends. We didn't have biomonitoring, so we couldn't go into the urine of school children, as I can do now with the data available, to see what kind of pesticides are in the urine of four-year-old girls or in the umbilical cord of infants, and then look to see whether concentrations of chemical X leads to increases in early puberty or brain tumors and so forth. And so I have a lot more data available to me than Carson did, and so with more data under my feet, the argument becomes a little more unassailable, I think. But probably the bigger factor here is I'm 50 years old. I was 5 years old when Rachel Carson died in the early 60s, and really the difference between her life and mine is 30 years of feminism. She actually was dying of breast cancer while writing Silent Spring. She lived in fear that her detractors in industry would find that out and use that to discredit her. And I think she was right about that, because they used the fact that she hadn't given birth to a child, even though she was an adoptive mother, to try to discredit her, saying that she's just a spinster, so why would she care about or know anything about future generations? I have to say that I haven't been attacked in that way, and I would like to believe that it wouldn't help the case of people who hold the opposite view of me to attack me based on the fact that I myself had cancer. In other words, my own identity as a cancer survivor has never been used to impeach my science, and I don't think the world would look kindly on anyone who would attempt to do that, even though that was considered a sort of legitimate critique of Carson at the time.
Well, Sandra Steingraber, we're actually out of time now. Thank you so much for being with us.
My great pleasure.
That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chiprananquine Agassian and Leonardo Alanis, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes, and follow us on Twitter at armudian.